field. In the Northwoods League, the Kingfish lost to the Royal Oak Leprechauns 3-2 last night. The two teams meet again tonight, 6:35 at Simmons Field. Now the forecast from the National Weather Service. Today, cloudy and warm. 50% chance of rain. That should be off and on. Today, a high of 79. A rainy night tonight, though. A low of 68. The weekend, Saturday, cloudy. 30% chance of morning rain, but pretty warm. Saturday's high, 86. And then Sunday, sunny and 73. Right now, humidity very high, 81%. Some light sprinkles in the area. 68 degrees for both Racine and Kenosha. For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. Coming up on 11 minutes after 8, the morning show with Greg Berg is next.
And we welcome you to the Friday morning show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. We have two newly recorded author interviews for you today. First, we hear from a Canadian philanthropist who has written a memoir about his many memorable encounters with all kinds of different celebrities through the course of his work. The book is called First to Leave the Party. In part two, I'll be speaking with a sports writer about the book Home Run King, a book published to commemorate the 50th anniversary of one of the most momentous landmarks in Major League Baseball history. 50 years ago, when Hank Aaron hit home run number 715, which broke the long-standing career home run record of none other than Babe Ruth. Here's part one of today's program. I have been thoroughly enjoying a brand new book, which is called First to Leave the Party, My Life with Ordinary People Who Happen to Be Famous. The author of this book is Saleh Bashir, and he is somebody who has been a mover and shaker in the world of entertainment, home video in particular, and has gone on to also become, particularly in his in Canada where he lives, has become one of the most successful and admired fundraisers and philanthropists, raising millions upon millions of dollars for all kinds of very, very worthy causes. And along the way, he has lived a life that one might say has been very much adjacent to fame. And over the course of his eventful life and career, he has encountered all kinds of famous people. And his really beautifully written book is a reflection on many of those remarkable people whom he has encountered over the years. So people like Marlon Brando and Liza Minnelli and Mary Tyler Moore and Princess Diana and Betty Davis and Aretha Franklin, and on the list goes. And with about each of them, he has something really interesting and perceptive to say. The book is published by Signal, again titled First to Leave the Party, My Life with Ordinary People Who Happen to Be Famous. Saleh Bashir, we welcome you to the morning show.
Thanks for having me. And what an introduction. Wow.
I really do love the book. And I do want to say, although I'm excited to get on to some of the famous people you talk about, I do want to touch on a couple of intriguing things that you talk about in the introduction to the book when you talk about your own life. You were born and raised in Lebanon until your family moved to Canada in 1965 when you were 10 years old. In the course of kind of talking about that, you say, all my life I have sought out community. Tell us more about this hunger for community and, in a sense, the way in which your own life, and the way it has unfolded, the things you've done, kind of folds into that desire for community.
You know, when you grow up in a small village and you leave when you're 10, you have a sense that everybody's there for you, that everybody will help you, whatever happens. People will take care of you. You walk to school and there's an uncle, an aunt, or somebody related to somebody who you met through somewhere. And being an immigrant to Canada or the U.S. and working in the U.S. as well, and being an Arab, really, Lebanese, and being knowing I was gay since I was eight. I opened the book that I knew I was gay when I was eight, and I found out I was an Arab when I think I was 12 or something. But you're never really part of any group. And when you hide your gayness as well, you play hockey and lacrosse and football, and you're damn good at it, by the way. And you still, you know, want to fit in somewhere. What exactly do you fit in? How do you have like-minded people and the language and stuff? And so I put that the same way as a celebrity walking into a room as someone trying just to relax, to having some downtime and not playing the part, not being a part, not being asked, I want to talk to you about your movie. I want to talk to you about this. I want to talk to you, just, hey, Jody, how are you? How are things? How are the kids? Kind of thing. And that's the whole, what brought me to both experiences and the book.
At one point you write, "My life is one of light and shadows, of fierce pride mixed with uncertainty, a kaleidoscope of hiding and revealing. I wanted to be known and I wanted not to be known." And I have a feeling that that's probably true about a lot of us, even if we don't maybe stop to take the time to kind of reflect on that. Has that always been the case? And has that become more or less true as life has gone on?
It's always been the case. And I think and you probably know as well as anybody else. I mean, it becomes more that you're identified as a certain person. This is actually the first interview I've done where you started off as fundraiser, and I'm very proud of that. So other labels are like haughty and like you judged you, like you wrote a check or something. But no, I always wanted to be known and not known, right? Be somebody, not go to an event, not go to an art show and have people give you their cards about their art openings or send you invitations to everything knowing that you buy art or you're an arts patron or not have people who've never met you send you proposals on Facebook about, you know, donations and not doing their homework as well. I mean, the two tie in. So, like, sometimes you just want to go somewhere and just be nothing, not be known, not be anything. And there's a great story that friends in New York tell and about Katharine Hepburn being on a corner store from 49th Street where she lived in the area in Turtle Bay and squeezing some apples and said, you know, somebody said, "Oh, Miss Hepburn, what are you doing here?" She said, "Buying apples." And so it's like, really, sometimes it's just that simple a gesture that you just want to disappear.
I want to ask you one other question about your homeland of Lebanon. And at one point, you say, "The romance and longing of the place is still there for me, even if it," meaning Lebanon, "is no longer my community." And I'm sure tied up in that, among other things, is the fact that in Lebanon, it is illegal to be gay. When you return to Lebanon, and I know you've done that from time to time through the course of your life, how have you handled that? I mean, both sort of from a practical point of view, have you, in a sense, had to hide who you are when you are in Lebanon? But also, what does it feel like to be in this country that means so much to you, and yet a place that, at least in this official way, is not welcoming to you and who you are?
You know, we used to go back to Lebanon twice a year, and during COVID we haven't, and after my surgeries and plan to go back. I've never hidden it. My husband's come with me and we have a house there. The law is the law, and there's a lot of anti-trans and anti-queer laws right now in the U.S. and other places. So if I was to go to Florida or anywhere else, I'm going to be who I am, and somebody has to deal with it. Am I afraid? A little bit, but again, the community rallies and protects us. All of my family there, all of our friends, you know, first thing they ask is, "How's Jacob?" So I think living a lie your life and hiding is not going to work for anybody, and it takes a tremendous toll on you and the We avoid areas that we think there may be problems, and in our area there isn't. And there's, you know, 69 other countries in the world that have anti-gay laws, and some kill gays, and like everybody talks about going to Dubai or Brunei or any of those countries, and you just have to do it. You just have to be who yourself and can't hide. But you take precautions as well.
Sure. We're speaking with Saleh Bashir about his book, First to Leave the Party, My Life with Ordinary People Who Happen to Be Famous. And it is a dizzying array of famous people whom he writes about in this intriguing book. And it has been your work in the entertainment industry particularly, and much of your philanthropic work that has allowed you to have many of these encounters. One of the things you say in general about your encounters with some of these really, really famous people is that I admired them, but I did not fawn over them or ask them what it was like to be them. I did not want to come across as part of a chorus line of sycophants. I would love to hear a little bit about this line between, you know, obviously admiring somebody like Stephen Sondheim or Marlon Brando or Liza Minnelli, and yet not wanting to fawn over them. How does one do that? I mean, in what sorts of, in what ways would you sort of govern the way you would interact with these famous people so to not cross that line into fawning?
Well, I think the thing is, I wanted to be myself in every situation. I didn't, you know, I liked the performance or liked their music or liked who they were. You know, sitting in Ella Fitzgerald's backyard for a barbecue or having her make eggs for dinner. I mean, I talk about it now, but then you didn't really know, or you didn't want to sink into that world, but you didn't want to be part of a chorus of, you know, Stephen can do anything or Liza. You didn't want to be a hanger-on. You didn't want to be any. I didn't want to be any of those things. I wanted to be on my terms, kind of thing. And your celebrities are a lot of work. Like, not them, the person themselves, but what everybody expects of them and people around them. So it wasn't like I'm going to go to any extra length. And I think once you start fawning and talking about them and feeding their own ego, then at some point you're lost in everything.
Hmm.
Got part of that background.
One of my favorite paragraphs in the whole book is when you say, I was not interested in their celebrity per se, but in what they did with it. The causes they championed, the good they did in the world by using their platform, the resilience they showed in handling not only fame, but the vicissitudes of an amplified life. And that's such an interesting turn of phrase, the amplified life. I think that is a good way to think of what life is like for these sorts of celebrities, and also, you know, part of what makes it sort of glorious and yet also can make it very, very difficult.
Yeah, I mean, and the whole book is exactly about what they did with their celebrities. But also, I mean, I have to admit, if I wanted a celebrity for something, I also wanted to get a fundraiser out of them or pay tribute to them late in their careers to, you know, and sell out an audience and put attention on them. So in the video industry, there was all these films that were released after the star was no longer, you know, a big star like Gregory Peck or Ginger Rogers, and we pay tribute to those and use their celebrity to also fundraise for different causes. And, you know, Elizabeth Taylor having the first major AIDS charity, Paul Newman and what they've done with their foundation. Even Andy Warhol, people don't know that Andy Warhol Foundation, he left a lot of the art to the foundation, and they've given about $400 million to different galleries and museums to help them get going. So it's that generosity I want. It's not anything else, and, you know, in that sense.
Let me ask you about a couple of the people that you write about in your book. One of the names that just leapt out to me, just because I so admire her work as an actress, is the late Patricia Neal. And one of the things you write about her is, I wanted to know more about her, particularly her survival skills. And of course, probably a lot of our listeners are aware that she suffered several personal tragedies in her life and also had to come back from the effects of a devastating stroke. What did you end up learning about her so-called survival skills?
Her courage, her tenacity, her being herself no matter what, and still glowing. I think one of the quotes in there is that at one point she was compared, when she did HUD with Paul Newman, she was compared to Katharine Hepburn and Betty Davis. This is the next big star. But you know what I'm learning a little bit more now is that there was a, when we walked in by her house in Martha's Vineyard, she held on to me for dear life walking on the cobblestones. And after all my surgeries and survival skills, and, you know, I had a sepsis and ileostomy reversal and had to relearn to walk three times. Every time I hold on to my husband going somewhere, that scene comes back in my life in that she didn't want to slip. She didn't want to fall. She avoided doing certain things that she had learned she had to do, but also her passion for life, her passion for people. She was, you know, amazing, amazing woman that inspired me in many, many ways. And I thought of her a lot when I was in hospital and different things, or what she had gone through and how she beat it. And she wasn't religious at the time. She became religious later on, but relying on her self-determination that I'm going to beat it.
Mm. And you write in part about deciding to break your rule about ever staying in someone else's home. You actually stayed in the home of Patricia Neal, and that led to an even closer encounter with her, and it's so interesting to read about that. You tell us about the way in which you ultimately ended up meeting the great Stephen Sondheim, and unlike just about everybody else in this book, where you just crossed paths with them through the course of your life and your career, and you were, you know, just kind of moving in the same circles. In a sense, I mean this in the best sense of the word, you had to kind of go after Stephen Sondheim in a way that he evidently found charming, and you ultimately went out for lunch and had a lovely time together. Would you mind sharing with our listeners what you did in order to make this connection with Stephen Sondheim, someone you tremendously admired?
Well, I became a stalker. I very much, you could say that. I would leave the best flowers outside his door. I knew where they lived. And so we'd be in town watching, you know, Into the Woods or Passion or any Sunday in the Park with George or anything. And I would leave a big bouquet of flowers with a note. If you ever want to, you know, love this about this and love that. And, you know, even other shows like Anyone Can Whistle or so Sondheim was it for us. And, you know, I knew different flowers. He didn't like lilies because they smelled different ways. And so mostly roses and peonies and a card and leave my business, not my, a personal card. If you ever want to have lunch. And I think after maybe the seventh or eighth time, his assistant called and said, yes, but next time in New York, you know. And Lutèce used to be the great French restaurant not far from both either him, Hepburn's or his residence on 47th Street. Hmm. I think 47th or 49th, the restaurant itself, but in that area in Turtle Bay. So, yeah, that happened, and it was a charming conversation, and it wasn't. And then we had lunch a few times. One time he brought the great Lee Remick with him, and my cousin thought it was his wife. And so it ended up, there was a fundraiser for the Gray Men's Health Crisis at Carnegie Hall. I think it was 1995, and Angela Lansbury, Bernadette Peters, and a few others. And he was on stage, and we got seats in the front row, and he recognized me, called me on stage, and gave me a big hug and kiss, and that's how I made it to Carnegie Hall. Hmm. What else do I need?
Right. As a big opera fan, my eyes lit up when I saw the name Jesse Norman among the notable people you write about in your book. And I've had the pleasure of doing a phone interview with her when her memoir was published. What's so intriguing about your encounter with Jesse Norman is that when you encountered her, if I remember correctly, you really had no idea who she was. You were very taken with her and just kind of her persona, but you really, that's not a part of sort of the music world that you evidently followed at all. And you shared this with her, and she must have found that somewhat charming, and the two of you ended up connecting in a very positive way. I just find that to be a really intriguing story.
Well, I mean, I did. My uncle had invited her to lunch again at the restaurant in New York I've mentioned. And she walked into the room, and it's like, you know, like everybody recognized her. There was a little bit of clapping almost. She came, and she was dressed fabulously and incredible. And just being in her presence is like, I mean, she really is like a spotlight on, she didn't need a spotlight, but it was on her and her manner, and she wanted to know everything about everyone. And she also had performed like Ella Fitzgerald in Lebanon at these huge old Roman ruins called Baalbek. And a friendship developed through my uncle, who's Lebanon's ambassador to the UN. And then I did become a huge opera fan. We did become, and at one point when I was the film company here, Cineplex, we did play the Met Opera on screens. And then the weird part is she would call me in the hospital, and as I said, I was like for 4 or 5 months, and then out of the blue, but I'd be on all these drugs, and on your cell phone she would sing me Somewhere.
And it wow would be
like, you know, and I would blast it. And the younger nurses didn't know who she was but knew the song. And so that her and Ben Vereen would call me in the hospital and sing to me. And then the sad part is she died of sepsis while I was battling sepsis.
Wow.
And so, so that was like a very, very sad, very beautiful memories and beautiful person, but... still choked up about that one.
Sure.
But, I mean, if you ever saw her in opera, if you ever saw her on stage, there was like a dominance there. Oh. She didn't have to earn anything. She just walked up and, you know, sang, and it was incredible.
Yeah, a force of nature, for sure. I want to say that one of the things that I think a lot of people will appreciate about your book is that so much of what you have to say about these people is quite positive. But when there is something that needs to be said about someone and it's of a more difficult nature, you are not reluctant to do so. And two of the more negative chapters, if I may describe it that way, in your book are the chapters where you talk about Joan Rivers and Jimmy Stewart in a couple of different ways. With Joan Rivers, you say describing her as high maintenance is actually, you know, probably the kindest way to describe her bad behavior. She was someone who performed for one of your fundraising galas, and you were deeply disappointed. And later in the chapter, you write, she was so wound up for success and unable to get any distance from it, wanting desperately to be the Lucille Ball of her time. I think that I really appreciate the fact that, I mean, there are plenty of people in the world who did not care for Joan Rivers for various reasons, but I think a lot of times that people do not take the time to be thoughtful about it. And I really feel like you are thoughtful in the way that you talk about Joan Rivers and the way in which she ultimately was, in a sense, a disappointment to you.
I talked to her about her positively. I mean, she did a lot of positive things. We had worked together on different things, but slowly that kind of humor hurts people, and that kind of disappointment we don't prepare. But I think she was on a treadmill. She was trying to be everything to everyone, and that was a very disappointing night. We had a great local singer named Jackie Richardson, who's huge jazz, and she had done one song and got a standing ovation, and Joan said, get her off stage, or get that bitch off stage. And she was ruining my opening, like my act, and then all the jokes she hadn't prepared for the audience, all the jokes she had done were dated. She even it was for a community center here, which is one of the largest queer community centers in the world, around for 50 years, called the 519, and she was doing jokes about gay AIDS survivors, like running out of money, and we had lunch another time, and we met a few other times, and she knew I was disappointed, but I think, again, she tried to be Joan, the TV persona all the time. There was no downtime. Mm. Whereas somebody like Phyllis Diller, all the jokes, you know, I got to know Phyllis Diller, all the jokes were about her or her imagined husband, Fang. And at the end of it, she did the ha kind of thing that, It was not hurtful about Elizabeth Taylor's Wade or about Marlon Brando or Orson Welles. Sometimes people gain weight for many different reasons, drugs or anything. They're on for kidney transplants or anything else. And so I found her hurtful. So I tried to write as gently as possible.
Right. I think that's a very fair characterization. And again, I use the term thoughtful. I mean, You share with us, you know, some reasons for your disappointment, as you do with the actor Jimmy Stewart. In that chapter, you write, slowly with each encounter, I learned to love the real Jimmy Stewart a little less. And that was, of course, because politically and socially, you were very much on different pages. And I, again, appreciate the thoughtfulness with which you write about him and your feelings about him. I want to close by asking you about the intriguing subtitle of your book, My Life with Ordinary People Who Happen to Be Famous. Explain that subtitle and this notion of these famous people who at one point you actually describe as extraordinary. I think in the introduction to the book, you kind of make passing reference to the extraordinary people that I've met. And yet, in your subtitle, you say, my life with ordinary people who happen to be famous. Can you just help us understand the ordinary quality of these famous people that you write about?
I think it's important that we don't treat celebrity or we don't treat someone on a pedestal, or they can do no wrong, or they, you know, people all, as I said, with Patricia Neal or other people, they have health issues, they're rejected, they're not in films anymore, they're not the flavor of the day. Sometimes, you know, the great Marlon Brando couldn't get a part, or others. So as my encounters with them, they did extraordinary things with their lives, but at the end of the day, they're just ordinary people that you treat as ordinary and don't fawn over them.
Well, and of course, when one is thinking about them as not larger than life figures, but as human beings who happen to be really great at something or who have achieved great success, but human beings all the same, flesh and blood, often with great vulnerabilities, which sometimes they work very hard to shield from the rest of us, it just seems like they are so much more interesting when they are treated as human beings. And that's, I think, part of what makes your book so intriguing. The book is First to Leave the Party, My Life with Ordinary People Who Happen to Be Famous, published by Signal. The author, Sala Bashir. Sala Bashir, thank you, first of all, for all the good that you've done in the world. And thank you so much for writing such an interesting book and for being my morning show guest to talk about it. Very best wishes to you.
Thank you very much. Loved it. Loved the interview.
You're listening to The Morning Show on WGTD HD, your gateway to public radio. I'm Gregory Berg. April 8th, 2024, marked the 50th anniversary of one of the most incredible moments in professional sports history. That is the day Hank Aaron broke the long-standing record of Babe Ruth when Hank Aaron struck home run number 715. 50 years later, we are still coming to grips with this extraordinary accomplishment and the remarkable athlete responsible for it. We can now read about this particular quest to break the home run record in a great new book called Home Run King, The Remarkable Record of Hank Aaron. The book is written by Dan Schlossberg, former Associated Press sports writer, who is responsible in one way or another for maybe 40 different baseball books, including several different autobiographies and biographies, and has written extensively in a lot of different publications about this sport, which he loves so very, very much. He is someone who has been a Braves fan for just about all of his life, and that's one of the reasons why he was a great choice to pen this particular book. And we are going to be speaking now with Dan Schlossberg about Home Run King, The Remarkable Record of Hank Aaron. Dan Schlossberg, we welcome you to The Morning Show.
Thanks, Greg. Great to be with you.
Tell our listeners, first of all, just a little bit about your own relationship with the great game of baseball.
I began in 1957, which was a big year for Milwaukee, the only year the Milwaukee Braves won the World Series, and Hank Aaron led them to the World Series. And I remember watching on the old black-and-white Zenith TV in my living room in New Jersey. My father turned down the sound and told me what was going on, and I fell in love with the Milwaukee Braves. And living in the New York market, the Dodgers and Giants were going to California. Everybody I knew rooted for the Yankees, but I figured, hey, the Braves beat them. The Milwaukee Braves were the best team. I've stayed with them ever since.
Very good. And, of course, I'm talking to you right down the road from Milwaukee, Wisconsin, so this particular connection is especially delicious. So you actually loved the sport of baseball and sports in general from a very, very early age. It might be surprising to some people just how young you were when you first got to speak with the great Hank Aaron. Explain what happened back in 1965 when you were, I think, just 17 years old.
I was a senior in high school in Passaic, New Jersey, and I had to write a column every month for the high school newspaper, the Hilltop Star. I was a sports editor. I decided I wanted to do a column on sportsmanship. And why not interview the manager of the Milwaukee Braves, Bobby Bregan? That would give me a chance to see a Braves game, talk to the Braves manager, and get on the field in New York at Shea Stadium. And that's exactly what I did. And I got to meet Hank Aaron that day, and it was really, what can I say? It was a godsend, I guess, a gift. And I became friends with Hank Aaron and stayed friendly with him right through the end of his life.
Hmm. So tell us about the decision to write a book specifically about this record broken by Hank Aaron. I mean, in some respects, it's a no-brainer, especially with this 50th anniversary. But I'm just curious kind of what went through your mind in terms of exactly how to talk about this, write about this, and in particular, what had not already been said that needed to be said.
Among other things, this was my second Hank Aaron biography. I did one way back in 1974, 50 years ago, called Hammer and Hank, The Henry Aaron Story. And that was just a straight biography about everything he had done in his life on and off the ball field. This one, 50 years later, after he's already been gone, documents not only what he did as an athlete, but also as an advocate for civil rights. And living in Atlanta helped him meet people like Jesse Jackson, who was in Chicago, but he would come to Atlanta to meet with Ralph David Abernathy and Martin Luther King Sr., Martin Luther King Jr., Andrew Young, and others. And Hank Aaron had already decided he was going to pick up Jackie Robinson's torch and run with it. Jackie Robinson had passed away, but he and Aaron were very close. And that happened because way back when Hank Aaron was a teenager, 1947, the Brooklyn Dodgers came through Mobile, Alabama, where Aaron lived, on a barnstorming tour. And Hank went to hear Jackie Robinson talk and became a friend of his. And Aaron also befriended some of the early black Dodgers like Roy Campanella, Dan Bankhead, Don Newcomb. And he said to me that the card games they played were like college classes for anybody else. Taught him so much about life and especially civil rights.
I love that. So there are, for as celebrated a player as Hank Aaron was, and you call him the best player you ever saw, and for all that he accomplished, even beyond this amazing home run record, he hit, of course, 755 before his career was over. You remind us that there are a couple of ways in which Hank Aaron actually was perhaps not then nor to this day maybe properly appreciated, and part of it had to do with the kind of person he was, and part of it had to do with where he played. Tell us about both of those factors.
Yeah, very well said, Greg. Milwaukee and Atlanta before the Superstation were both small market cities. It's not like Willie Mays playing in New York and San Francisco or any of the other big-name stars, Mickey Mantle playing in New York, Ted Williams playing in Boston. Aaron played in small cities. Couple that with his personality, introverted, humble, low-key. He even told his kids, I'm not a celebrity, I'm just a guy going to work like any other guy goes to work. And his kids followed that philosophy as well. Aaron was humble, introverted, modest, never blew his own horn. And as a result, they said he lacked charisma. Don Drysdale even said he looked like he was falling asleep between pitches. Of course, against Don Drysdale, he hit more home runs than he hit against any other pitcher. He hit 17. He also batted 362 against Sandy Koufax, 342 against Steve Carlton. So obviously Hank Aaron was wide awake when it counted. He was just a remarkable player in every aspect of the game. He won 3 gold gloves. Nobody remembers that. He was the first guy to get 3,000 hits and 500 home runs. Just a great player, 305 lifetime batting average, first in extra base hits, first in total bases, first in runs batted in, and first in clean home runs. No steroids involved.
Right. And you remind us that he was an all-star a record 25 times in 23 seasons. Explain how mathematically such an amazing accomplishment could be possible.
Good question. I'm glad you pointed that out. He was not an all-star in his rookie year of 1954 or in his last year of 1976. However, he was an all-star in 21 years in a row, all the other years, and 4 of those years, Major League Baseball played 2 all-star games to raise money for the players' pension fund. That's how he did it. Those 2 all-star games a year for 4 years from 1959 through 1962, that helped him be an all-star 25 times.
Right. And however, as we were just saying, even accomplishments like that did not necessarily dramatically resonate across the country because of where he played and because of his personality. At one point, you write in your book, too quiet, too modest, and too humble, Hank Aaron let his bat speak for him. I think that's really
said. Very true, Greg. In fact, if you look at the results of the MVP voting, he won only once, and that was in 1957 when he hit the pennant-winning home run in Milwaukee against Billy Muffet of the St. Louis Cardinals. That was the only home run that Muffet had given up at that point in the season. This was a late September home run that won the pennant for the Milwaukee Braves. But the voters from the MVP voted him the award only once in 57. He never even was a runner-up in any other season, which is preposterous. I mean, it's ridiculous that he never finished second any other year. In 59, when he batted 355 and had 400 total bases, he certainly should have been the National League MVP and not Ernie Banks. And I can give you other years, too. 63, when Sandy Koufax won, Aaron was the best position player by far, and he played far more often than Sandy Koufax played. There were other years, too. 71, he could have won the award. I'm suggesting in my book that there could have been 4 or maybe even 5 times when Aaron could have been the MVP. And the same goes for the 1957 World Series. He led both teams in all 3 Triple Crown categories. But Lou Burdette, who pitched 3 complete games in the World Series, 2 of them shutouts, got the Chevrolet for being the MVP of the World Series. I think Aaron should have won that too. And lastly, the Hall of Fame voting of 1982, 9 voters left Hank Aaron completely off their 10-man ballots. Again, preposterous.
Absolutely. That's one of the most shocking things to contemplate. You remind us that for as spectacular as this home run record is, the other aspect of his playing and of his excellence that we need to remember is that, in your words, he was a model of consistency. And then you spell out some statistics that sort of show this, demonstrate this, that he was not like some spectacularly gifted players, sort of up and down with ebb and flow. I mean, he produced excellence with incredible consistency throughout the course of his career.
Very true, Greg. He never hit more than 47 home runs in any single season. He matched his uniform number 44 a number of times, however, and slow but steady gets the worm or gets the job done any way you want to look at it. And if you look at Barry Bonds' record by contrast, the only season in which Barry Bonds hit as many as 50 home runs was the year he had 73. So as Yogi Berra might say, something's not kosher in the state of Denmark.
We need to talk about this particular gauntlet leading up to April 8th, 1974, when Hank Aaron finally broke Babe Ruth's record. First of all, explain at what point it became clear that this record was within reach. And then to what extent was this a record that Hank Aaron was really, in a sense, actively pursuing?
In 1973, Hank Aaron was one of 3 Braves who hit 40 or more home runs. And that tied, that actually was a record at that time. It's been duplicated several times since. In fact, most recently by the 2023 Atlanta Braves. But that was the first time 3 teammates ever hit 40 home runs in a season. When Aaron hit 40 home runs, he finished with exactly 40, even though he wasn't playing every day at that point in time. He started to think, hey, you know what? I can catch Babe Ruth's record. However, a lot of bigots out there also got the same thought, and they didn't want a white man's hallowed record falling to a black man. And Aaron got tons and tons of mail, 930,000 pieces of mail, more than any non-politician in the country, even got a plaque from the post office. Now, not all of that was hate mail. Most of it was encouraging, he said. But enough of it was awful, threats against his family, threats against his kids. His kids were not even present on April 8, 1974, because there were threats against their lives. Aaron did not want his kids to take a chance in case anything happened. Mm. So they were with their biological mother in Jacksonville, Florida, watching it on TV. And Aaron had to room separately on the road from the team. He had to eat separately from his teammates. It was almost like in 1953 when he was in the minor leagues at Jacksonville in an all-white league, an all-white team. It was almost like living that all over again.
Mm. How, from talking to him, how do you think he was able to withstand that kind of pressure? Not only the pressure of trying to achieve this incredible record, but knowing that there were plenty of people who not only did not want him to achieve the record, but at least threatened him with bodily harm. I mean, how does an athlete deal with something like that? How did Hank Aaron deal with something like that?
He learned how to turn the other cheek. He did read the hate mail that came in, and Dusty Baker told me that he would throw it on the floor in the clubhouse after he read it so the other black players could see it. But Hank Aaron was very aware of what was going on around him. He had an FBI agent assigned to him. He had all kinds of security. In fact, when he hit that 715th home run, you might recall 2 kids ran out on the field right after he passed second base.
Right.
They just wanted to congratulate him, but for a moment, it looked like maybe they wanted to kill him before he completed the circuit of the bases. That's what was going on. You know, he told Dusty Baker and Ralph Garr, not to sit next to him on the bench in case somebody shot him during the game. This is what he was dealing with. So he learned to turn the other cheek, but boy, he had a lot of obstacles to overcome. But having grown up in Mobile, Alabama, he learned all about segregation and racial hatred. As a boy, he had to hide under the bed when the Ku Klux Klan marched down the street in front of his house.
Mm. Incredible. Let's talk for just a quick moment about the move to Atlanta and to the Atlanta Stadium, which proved to be, not that he didn't have some really happy times in Milwaukee and tremendous success, but it made a real difference, this move to Atlanta. Explain why that was such a critical factor in Hank Aaron's pursuit of the home run record.
He loved the city of Milwaukee and actually wound up playing 12 years there and 9 years in Atlanta. But when he got to Atlanta and realized what the altitude was, Atlanta actually has some altitude. It's currently third in Major League Baseball in altitude behind Denver and Arizona. Atlanta is third. That altitude helps the ball fly there. And when he saw Atlanta Stadium, Atlanta Fulton County Stadium, where he first played, he learned how to become a pretty much of a full-time pull hitter. And because of that, was able to hit 40, 44 home runs every year. He only got hurt as a rookie in 1954 when he broke his leg in September. Other than that, he stayed pretty much injury-free, and that helped him get to where he did, 755 home runs.
Hmm. It says something about the high regard with which he was held that that when he managed to, I think it was when he hit 714, which tied Babe Ruth's record, you tell us about his wife being congratulated by the wife of the pitcher. And she, that is Hank Aaron, also received a very special congratulatory telegram from a certain woman. Explain who that was.
Well, you're right. Jack Dillingham was the pitcher who gave up that home run, and Mrs. Dillingham actually went out of her way to congratulate Hank Aaron. And that was really incredible that happened. And that was in Cincinnati, and that was a whole big controversy because the Braves wanted not to even play Hank Aaron in that series. They wanted him to break the record in Atlanta, and he actually did. He broke the record in Atlanta, but he tied the record in Cincinnati, and they wanted him to do both at home for the Braves fans. They even had certificates printed. I was there when he hit 714, and I was there when he hit 715. Well, because of Jack Dillingham serving up that home run in the opener, where Aaron was ordered to play by Commissioner Bowie Kuhn, that 714 certificate became a phantom, and the Braves had to burn 50,000 certificates.
Hmm. So he ties it out of town, and a telegram arrives from the widow of Babe Ruth, which had to be a very sweet moment indeed.
Yes, Claire Ruth. She was a real sports person and a mensch. She really came through.
Absolutely. And, of course, Hank Aaron goes on then to break the record dramatically at home in Atlanta. And one of the things that you quote somebody observing is that as Hank Aaron rounded the base in that historic moment, basically, it looked like any other home run. I mean, as far as the way Hank Aaron carried himself, no histrionics, no theatrics, still the quiet, dignified man he had always been.
Very true. And there were actually three home run calls of that 715. Milo Hamilton on WSB Radio in Atlanta, and that's the one that's usually paired with the video. Vin Scully called it for the Dodgers, and Kurt Gowdy for NBC Game of the Week. So there are three different calls, three very different calls.
The book, again, is Home Run King, the remarkable record of Hank Aaron. It includes really lovely forwards by Dusty Baker and Kevin Barnes, who both knew Hank Aaron well, as did the author of the book, Dan Schlossberg, the book published by Sports Publishing. Dan Schlossberg, congratulations on a wonderful book. What a beautiful tribute this is to your friend and this great, great ball player. And thank you for being my morning show guest today. It was wonderful to talk with you.
Greg, thank you very much.
It is now 8:59. This is WGTD HD, Kenosha, Racine, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva. We'll be joining Wisconsin Public Radio's program, Wisconsin Today, shortly. quick check on the forecast from the National Weather Service. Cloudy and warm. Rain today off and on, a high of 79. It is raining now, 68 degrees for Scenic Kenosha, 64 for Burlington, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva at 9 o'clock.